Welcome, welcome, welcome. I'm your host, Henry Arslanian, and welcome to this episode of the Future Money Podcast. Before we start, I want to say big thank you to the 500,000 of you who follow my content each week. This podcast, The Future of Money, is now ranked in the top 5% of all podcasts globally on Spotify. And there's thousands of you each week from over 160 countries globally who are tuning in. So big, big, big thank you from the bottom of my heart. As all you loyal listeners know, my goal with this podcast is very simple. It's to go deep in some of the biggest ideas, trends, and developments we are seeing in the field of crypto, and hopefully empower you with this information and then let you make your own decision on what their impact could be, not only on the future of finance, but also on the future of money. And to do this, I invite each week one of the leading figures of the global crypto community to have this one-on-one conversation amongst crypto aficionados and discuss some of these topics. This episode today is part of the broader series called the Investor Series. Really, what we're discussing the broader topic of investing in crypto. We had numerous episodes already on the topics from operational due diligence to risk management and data in crypto. But today we have the privilege of talking with an allocator, somebody who's actually investing in crypto funds, and really try to cover the investment angle of the topic of investing in crypto. And we're very honored to have with us Mr. Yev Bebnev. He's a chief investment officer of Blockstone Capital. Yev, great to have you with us today on the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Henry. It's a real pleasure.
First of all, I want to have to say, you know, I always like to introduce my guests with something unusual about them. With you, there's two of them. One of them that you started mining Bitcoin in your garage in 2014, which is already, I would say, you know, quite unique. But what is even crazier with you, Yev, I have to say, I've had, I don't know, hundreds of guests on my show. You actually survived a plane crash in the year 2000. I don't know which, I mean, can you share, I mean, before we talk about everything else, how did you survive a plane crash?
Well, the plane crash was, it's, put it this way. Yeah, let's get the plane crash story out of the way. We ran out of fuel as we were basically pretty much coming into land. We're about maybe 5 miles away from the actual airport. And then the fuel gauge turned out to be sort of overreading a little bit. So the engine cut out, and then the reservoir, the second reserve tank was also empty. So obviously, once the propeller stopped spinning, and it was a propeller aircraft, a pretty large one at that, but it turns into a kind of, you know, something more like an aerodynamic brick, right, with short wings. So we ended up sort of ditching crash landing in a little bit of a field, and we rolled past some hedgerows and across the road and then into the next field. And it would have been all fine, apart from rotten luck that in that middle of the next field, there was a pile of set concrete, which we managed to find head on. But, you know, everyone walked away. So that means it's a great landing.
Incredible. I mean, I have to say, one of my favorite TV shows is the shows, you know, on Discovery Channel, where they analyze previous plane crashes. I find it's such a good industry, actually, where they learn from their mistakes. I wish we would do the same and have the same rigor in crypto, but I'm sure we'll talk about that. But also, can you share more that you started mining Bitcoin in 2014? How did that happen?
It's actually not Bitcoin that I was mining. By then, it was already about ASICs, and I actually felt that I was already a bit too late for the crypto revolution. So I've built like a mining array with my own sort of custom designed cooling solution, because obviously it was getting a bit hot. Just to give you a bit more of a background about that, I guess, I always like to tinker. I like tech. I owned every Oculus Rift, the VR headset, since the prototype. I've built a 3D printer from some DIY materials before that, and then I used that 3D printer to make a quadcopter. And it was just part of that larger sort of learning experience, I guess. And I think it all started back when my parents, bought me a Lego set. And it was my only one, sort of having been born in Lithuania and growing up there, you couldn't come by them very easily. So I never felt quite satisfied with that one set where you can buy just, you know, where you can just construct three things. So I guess that's kind of what shaped me in trying to use the building blocks that life gives you and basically try to create stuff. So with the mining machine, I've built a little array. I've designed this custom cooler. And then luckily, I was in the garage when it all happened. One of the components actually caught fire. And it's not because of my cooling solution. It's actually some poor quality control. So after that, I've sort of realized that maybe it's a little bit too risky to mine. And maybe I should just buy the tokens and approach it from a trading perspective rather than a mining perspective. So I've quickly converted the mining rig into, believe it or not, a biltong maker, you know, where you dry the meat. And it served me really well for years. It was amazing.
Well, that's, think about reusing. People say Bitcoin miners are, crypto miners are useless afterwards, but I guess you proved them,
Proved them wrong.
Yeah. Here we go. Well, yeah, great to have you on the show. It's really an honor to have you. Before we start, there's so many things I want to talk about today. I mean, I think plane crashes and Bitcoin mining are very interesting, but there's other things we want to talk about today. Before we start, I want to give my usual disclosure. Blockstone Capital is actually an investor in Nine Blocks Capital, the hedge fund where I'm a shareholder. And so I just want to put that disclosure out there. And also, Blockstone Capital may be invested in other previous or current investors or guests, companies or guests have been on the show as well. So I just want to put that disclaimer out there. Yev, before we kick off, can you maybe share, I mean, you shared your mining and your plane crash story, but can you share maybe a bit more about the audience, about your professional background? And what does Blockstone Capital do? And so we can, the audience can get to know you better before we kick off.
Sure. So I started my traditional finance career in 2005 when it was back when Kyoto Protocol was ratified. So it was in carbon emissions trading, actually. And then moved on to electricity, so the European power. And more recently, I was a partner at a commodity hedge fund with about half a billion AUM, where we traded oil, gas, carbon that I already mentioned, coal, and electricity. And my responsibilities ranged from, well, as a fund grew, obviously, they were numerous, but from research to portfolio management to building the actual portfolio management solutions, compliance, operations. So that's kind of what I suppose set me up for the current endeavor. And obviously the 2014, where we, you know, where I've already had some experience in crypto mining and kind of stayed pretty current with crypto development. So I guess that while I felt like I was already too late to the crypto revolution, it actually makes me more of an oldie now in terms of, you know, the track record. So, you know, when I studied my MBA at London Business School, I met my co-founder and we had a chat. He had a similar kind of walk in life where he was, he cut his teeth at Rothschild on the wealth management side and private banking. And we talked about the crypto revolution, the blockchain revolution. And this idea was born that, well, we need to, you know, while everyone evangelizes about the blockchain and Bitcoin, we actually need to bring the traditional finance to the crypto rather than the other way around and make it sort of familiar to the point of almost being boring to an institutional investor.
Very interesting. First of all, I think that we'll come back to that, making it boring to institutional investors. But also, I love the fact that you met your co-founder at business school. By the way, which I'm also an alumni of London Business School. You know, this is one of the great stories where you actually meet your co-founder in business school. It's a bit cliche, but it still happens. You know, so this is one of the great things of that perspective. I think, yeah, you just mentioned, obviously, you started as a commodities trader. You were in a commodities trading fund. You know, one question that comes up a lot in the crypto ecosystem is that are commodities traders better suited for crypto or Bitcoin, but that's a bit better than crypto than, let's say, people have been traditionally looking at equities, for example. What's your view coming from the commodity side?
Well, it's a dangerous question to answer, and I think there is no empirically correct answer here. What I would say, though, from my experience in commodities, the volatility is probably a little bit more familiar to the commodity traders, right? And I think there's a lot of parallelism in the commodities adoption curve as well that we're seeing in crypto as an asset class. I don't mean the parallelism that everyone talks about, like crypto is the next internet or the technology, but I mean from the institutional side. You know, when at the bank, some commodity trader comes in, he gets allocated a desk at a corner somewhere and everyone looks at him funny. I feel like this is crypto today, while commodities is already like, what? You don't have a commodities desk? So this is kind of where we headed, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's interesting how you mentioned how there is that. If you think about it, often people are surprised at how commodities are traded, actually, what the instruments are traded. You know, it's not only oil, obviously, from pork belly to coffee beans. It's a very, very interesting industry from that perspective, you know. So here we go. So I think I know it's a very touchy topic, actually, between the commodities guys and the equities guys. So we won't go more into it. But actually, I would also have to ask you about it, because obviously now, as a, you guys have a fund of hedge fund, and you're investing in crypto hedge funds, of course, right? What are the, some of the challenges you are seeing right now with the crypto hedge fund industry? I mean, you had the privilege of seeing, meeting, and investing in a large number of them. What are the challenges you're seeing with crypto hedge funds today?
I think a lot of it is, comes from the past couple of years that we had, which was the latest crypto explosion, which actually brought a lot of, I wouldn't say unsavory characters, but maybe less experienced characters. And again, from our point of view, that bringing traditional finance and industry standards into crypto, that was counterproductive. So we ended up with a lot of, what do I call it? Not dead weight, but something that now is being culled, and the, you know, the, through, exits and obviously the mergers and things like that. So, the biggest challenge I see these days is A, finding not only the great performance and the track record, but, you know, for the fund itself to actually have the correct controls, systems and controls in place, have the correct regulatory compliance in place. And of course, the team itself, to me, it's very important that it needs to be an experienced team. Again, if like talking about commodities traders here, like, in my people that I know from commodity side, they've experienced at least one big stop out per year in their trading life, right? And I think in crypto, when we heard this, probably a bad example to even mention her, but the lady from Alameda, the CEO, when she was doing the interview, and she, you know, she was essentially insinuating stop out. You know, there should be no such thing in crypto. So to me, this is all extremely counterproductive, and not to sound too blasé about it, in a way, I actually like what crypto is currently going through from that perspective.
What do you mean by that? You think it's because it's going to clean up? It's going to force crypto funds to kind of enhance?
Exactly. So all the strategy, so rather, people who were using the high tide lifts all boats, macro to masquerade as a strategy, they will be removed. And what you will have remaining is actually people from, you know, ex Morgan Stanley, ex Goldman's, and, you know, or just talented people in general with correct experience and I guess aims in life in place in order to actually make the crypto as an asset class a little bit more palatable for an institutional investor. And I'd like to also mention that we don't evangelize Bitcoin from our approach. You've noticed that I've never really spoken blockchain. All we care about is, like, we're not even putting a bet on whether Bitcoin survives in the next 20 years or Ethereum or whatever next token. All we're placing a bet on is that crypto as an asset class is definitely here to stay, in our opinion. And this is what we're building now, is a company that generates alpha from the asset class.
And how do you go by, let's say when you're, obviously you mentioned some of the elements are important, like, you know, operations control, regulation compliance. Actually, we just recorded at the Future Money podcast, two episodes on those topics in particular, because I agree with you. These are very important topics when it comes to the industry of the crypto fund industry becoming institutionalized. So I totally get it on the non-investment side. But on the investment side, you mentioned the team, right? I mean, what do you look for? Like, how do you pick a good crypto hedge fund manager compared to, let's say, the average one? Like, what are the things you're looking for when you're picking a hedge fund, crypto hedge fund?
So if you don't mind, I don't know how much time we have left, but I'll actually talk you through the whole process, because obviously the team aspect and the manager is actually just a component of it. So, first of all, we look at the hedge fund universe, the crypto hedge fund universe, which, you know, in our estimation is about 600 crypto hedge funds out there, right? That is being very generous with the description of what a crypto hedge fund is, of course. By the time you actually start putting any kind of sort of benchmarking to it or criteria to it, you'll probably end up with, I'd say 80, not even good ones, but ones that are worth keeping an eye on. But before we get there, what we do is we actually classify them into three different categories, which we see as structurally independent. And these categories are true for any other asset class as well. And one is fundamental, i.e. they're long biased, Warren Buffett approach. You pick a token or an equity as a, you know, if you were trading equity that you think will do better than the rest, in its class or in its group, and you stick to that. That's one way of generating alpha. Of course, on the way down, it doesn't protect you from, you know, losing money either. The other one is more of a discretionary approach. So it's a long short, CTA style. Again, the kind of world I'm from, where you could actually expect somebody to make money on the way down as well as up. And to go back to your previous question, I think my biggest disappointment from last year, for instance, monitoring the larger group there, not many CTA-style funds have managed to profit, or at least hang on to the initial profits they made from the amazingly big fall from 60K per Bitcoin to 16K. So that was a bit of a disappointment. I'm hoping that more professionals, even from commodities, will join the space, and that will quickly change. I know it's also a function of cost. It's not cheap to place a short in Bitcoin, but... there we are. And the third category is market neutral. So it's liquidity providers. They essentially, I wouldn't even call it market neutral. I'd call them delta neutral, because again, after the FTX, we found that you could call your strategy, you know, market neutral, but there's something in the market that, you know, makes you exposed. So from those three categories, we essentially apply a AI-infused modern portfolio theory kind of algorithm that suggests not only the names of the funds, but also their ideal weights. And that's stage one. Stage two is that's when we actually go and meet the managers. We have interviews. We conduct due diligence processes. We check their offices. And then if they pass, we put them into the third sort of ring, and that is to put them back into the algo to check whether they actually complement the portfolio. And if there's something that's of concern, we either try and fix it there and then with, well, I wouldn't say activism, but, you know, giving them a chance to change it, or simply put them on a watch list. And then the over sort of on top of that, we have a machine learning infused or rather not infused, but a machine learning algorithm that helps with risk management, where it gives us an early warning of sorts. When it monitors the market, it actually suggests which of the funds that we're invested in we should pick up a phone to and check if everything's okay with them. So that provides this extra layer of risk management on top of the one that the fund manager already has in place themselves.
That's very interesting, actually. How did you guys develop? You developed this AI tools in-house?
It took us, you know, it took us so long to get the FCA license when we applied for it back in 2021. We had plenty of time to, and I mentioned my love for tinkering. So, you know, in the absence of other things to do, we were just tinkering with the code. I mean, I tell you, we tried all sorts of things in terms of selecting and building a portfolio, like genetic evolution theory. We built that too. Problem is, it wasn't any more efficient than modern portfolio theory. But
as long as you don't burn down the house, I think everybody's happy
exactly.
With that perspective. So, yeah, I want to ask you. Obviously, you've done all these DD on a lot of these managers. You see, I mean, what is how would you say that investing in crypto hedge funds is different from investing in traditional hedge funds? I mean, I would argue that a lot of the funds in a traditional hedge fund space apply the same funnel approach to selecting managers. But what do you think it makes it different when somebody's investing in crypto hedge funds versus traditional hedge funds?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thanks. The obviously, you know, the extra volatility that we mentioned makes even a commodity trader's blush most time, right? So there's this need to understand not only the classic strategies, i.e., you know, let's say the carry trade or whatever is employed by the hedge fund manager himself and the nomenclature that's established, but also the, you know, how it interacts with the underlying which itself is very new, right? And that underlying is actually so different as well. It could be a straight Bitcoin, it could be a DAO, it could be a token, it could be a lending strategy in crypto or liquidity provision on SushiSwap or whatever. So it's you actually need to be experienced in both worlds to successfully make a judgment call on whether you think the strategy, even with a great track record, is actually any good, right? So I can give you the examples of, for instance, of the, I suppose, bad examples of how when it doesn't work, right? So there was this market neutral fund that I was keeping an eye on, and every month they would return to me, they would report to me a positive return. And until I started paying close attention, and then I realized that what he was doing, he was extrapolating as a year to date as he's positive. So when I ask him for a discrete return for May, he may actually have had a negative May, but owing to the previous positive months, he would actually then say, oh yeah, we're on track for 12% year to date. But he would really sort of bury it in the phraseology, where unless you're already attuned to the BS, you could have actually you could have actually come away with an impression that the guy is positive every month. The high tide lifts all boats, masquerading as a strategy, I've already mentioned. There was this great market neutral fund that I won't go into specifics, it's very easily identifiable, but essentially seemed like very great guys, again, great returns until FTX happened. And FTX in itself, okay, I mean, it's a chapter in the crypto industry. Some got caught, some got caught more, some less, some already seen this and managed to do something about it. But it's after that, it's what came as well. So when they come back to you and say, okay, look, it's how they reported it as well, right? So when you see them start doing some dodgy mental gymnastics, that already sets your sort of the alarm bells. But then as you monitor them, you realize that they never had a strategy. They were simply using the inefficiencies from FTX's massive inflows of VC, then siphoning through Alameda. So not only did they lose like half of their AUM to the FTX collapse, they were also... they never actually had a strategy to begin with. They were just at the right place at the right moment in time until they weren't.
Interesting. I mean, the example you give of people giving like forward-looking annualized returns, I mean, this is, it's border. I mean, I'm pretty sure it's actually illegal. I mean, from a regulatory, I've never looked at it, but it's definitely not the right way to report your numbers. And I think what you said of transparency, I think is something that in the crypto industry, the fund industry, but also other parts of the crypto ecosystem, I mean, it's, you know, if you're not being transparent, you're taking your investors like for being idiots, basically, right? So it's just, I think it's very mature, actually, from that perspective. I mean, you must have seen, you've done the diligence on so many funds. Like, what are some of the crazy stories you've seen? Like, have you seen, like, stuff that you don't think you would have seen if you're running a normal traditional hedge fund?
I've got maybe a couple of stories I could share. One of them is probably possible in traditional fund. And that is simply, there was this great hedge fund, again, very stable returns, something we liked because we saw the crypto winter in 2021 and we documented it and we already were positioning within our strategy. As I mentioned, we're actually able to lean one way or the other in those groups so we can actually hope to be positive even in a negative year. So we're already monitoring the market neutral funds a little bit more than the rest. And this fund was absolutely fantastic on paper. Until we started doing the due diligence, and it turns out they have their own discretionary trading portfolio, and then a hedge fund as an afterthought. And when you present it with the person who represents the hedge fund, you ask them about the strategies employed, and they're like, "Oh yeah, we're doing this carry trade, we're doing the volatility harvesting, and I did options for the last 15 years. I love options." Immediately. Not to even sort of trip them up, I was just asking more about the specific strategies, because to me that's another thing that's not quite yet mature in crypto, or at least it's quite consolidated, right, in the hands of just a couple of platforms, and then he just volunteers the fact that actually that strategy isn't even employed at the hedge fund; it's employed by the discretionary portfolio, which well, frankly, has nothing to do with our DD call because the discretionary portfolio is not available to us to invest in. So the commingling of these things was just outrageous. And then what essentially the final nail in the coffin was when I asked them about the actual algo, because they do self-custody and they were sophisticated guys, don't get me wrong. You know, they're talking about the development team of 20 people. So I asked them, you know, who manages them? And the response is, a manager. I said, well, can I have a name? And the response is, well, do I have to provide you with a name? And I'm sitting there, I'm like, well, you don't have to provide it, but, you know, I simply won't invest. You know what I mean? It's like, I'm not the police, but this lack of transparency is just shocking. But the more outrageous call I had, somebody insisted that I take that call. There was this guy who already collected about a million of other people's money to run his strategy. He had zero experience in TradFi, but he was pretty good at coding. This is before ChatGPT, of course. Now everyone's great at coding. he was a retail guy, and he was trying to raise more money. And essentially, he described to me this this bottle he built. And it went something like this. So imagine Shiva, right? The goddess with many, many hands, in fact, 100 hands. And in each hand, she has $100. And with that $100, she can buy a token, different token, right? And as soon as she makes 1% on that token, she will take the money and invest into a different one. So I asked, like, okay, and what happens if you don't make the money? It's like, well, it's okay, you hold it until you do. So, okay, but what happens once all the hands fill up with the ones that don't? He's like, he actually got aggressive at this point and goes, no, no, you're not listening. I have 100 hands. Like, they will not all make, you know, stop losing money. But also, when they do, I actually allow it to double up on the position so that it can get into profit quicker. So at this point, I asked him if he knows a martingale strategy, and he didn't. So I advised him to read up on it, and we kind of left it at that. But the fact that he already attracted 1 million of other people's money with a pretty big, impressive pipeline, according to him, of other investors willing to invest, it was quite shocking. And that's, again, everything that we are not setting out to do here. So, yeah.
Exactly. It's pretty crazy, actually. But what do you think? So, I mean, how come do you think individuals like the Shiva with 100 hands, right? The guy managing that fund. I mean, how are they able to raise money? Do you think because it's let me reframe it another way. Do you think that when it comes to investor education in investing in crypto funds, do you think that we are really at the first inning? Or it's FOMO? Do you believe it's just people are sophisticated, but they're happy to cut corners in crypto? Why do you think that such funds are still able to raise money, and why some of the basic due diligence or risk management is not in place when people are doing due diligence on crypto funds?
Great question. I think back then it was mostly fueled by two factors. One is FOMO and the availability of the COVID-free money, right? When every household was receiving thousands of dollars and sitting at home. So that 1 million was probably many retail investors rather than sophisticated people. So that was one chapter that is obviously now being corrected, and thank God for that. But currently, I think the adoption itself is not even in the beginning. What we've seen is more of a transfer of VC funds, again, mentioning COVID, from places like FTX or, you know, other VC startups and into the crypto industry. But in the sense that we're looking for people who are looking for actively managed services in the asset class, I don't think we're anywhere near yet. By the time, like when pension endowment funds start asking and knocking on your doors, then you know we've had institutional adoption. Right now, it's not even the beginning.
Yeah. You know, it's one last question, yeah, before we move to the fire round. It's basically, you know, when you mentioned earlier in the show that, you know, you're looking forward to the day where there's a lot more, like, you know, people with TradFi backgrounds coming and managing funds, right? But when you look at the future of asset management and you look, let's say, 3, 4, 5 years down the line, How do you see the future of crypto asset management? Do you believe we'll be still in a centralized world where it is, we have the centralized custodians, we have the centralized exchanges where people are, trading and doing arbitrage and or taking directional bets? Or do you think that we'll have more of a DeFi ecosystem where kind of you have these DeFi managers, but offering really in the DeFi world without some of these centralized players? And overall, how do you think this is going to impact the future of the industry?
So in terms of asset management, I think... Well, specifically on the asset management, we see it becoming an integral part of most large asset managers, not only in the form of a crypto desk that I mentioned, in my commodities story, like a desk in a department in a corner somewhere, but actually synergizing with the rest of the asset managers' operations. First of all, we have CBDCs already a thing, right? Thailand just released some news with Singapore. So around the world, these will take off, and your FX desk suddenly will need to have the know-how of crypto through the virtue of handling CBDC, right? Or at least the CBDC API, and you'll need the relevant experts. Equity desks will start commingling equity and, or rather your classic equity and equities of pure play blockchain companies, because, well, they do have value. So, while you might have a different opinion on something like a DeFi yield farming protocol that's printing their own token and yield, but there are many companies out there that are actually producing revenue and value out there, and they will be listed in one way or the other. And on the commodity side, and I know I'm probably talking commodities more than crypto here, in the show, but one of the most hotly discussed topics today is actually in the European market alone, where there's over €1 billion worth, in fact, €1.5 billion worth of daily traded volume per day. And that's already and always has been essentially a, I wouldn't say fully digital, but essentially a record product. I don't know if you know it, Henry, but it's carbon emissions, the cap and trade system. It's been around since 2005, as I mentioned at the beginning of my of your show. It's already a record on a ledger. So I only see further synergies there, where instead of having a registry in Switzerland, then in Europe, then in the UK, and those registries don't talk to each other, put it all on blockchain. That's the only way we'll get to carbon neutrality.
Interesting. It's very interesting, actually, on carbon. I mean, we could have a whole episode on that on that topic, right? We were discussing recently with another guest on when it comes to Bitcoin mining and the impact it has. But I think you're right. I mean, from a trading perspective, I mean, the industry is bigger, and there's obviously a great use case there for blockchain and digital assets as well to play a role in. We have to finish it off with my favorite bell is with me here. So I'm going to ask quick questions. And I need one or two word answers to my question. And the bell here will keep us honest, like a good old commodities trade. Hope you're ready.
Let's see.
Here we go. Yev, you've flown a lot of planes and you're flying aficionado. What is the one favorite plane or aircraft that you love?
The Blackbird. Easy.
Oh, wow. Interesting. Oh, man, I'd love to hear more about that. Why, by the way? Why?
So another passion of mine is space. I actually helped write a paper to a Luxembourg space agency about asteroid mining. So I love space. And if somebody could give me a pickaxe and send me onto an asteroid, I would probably go.
Amazing. Well, coming to my next question. What's your favorite space movie or aviation movie?
There's quite a few, but I guess Odyssey.
Odyssey, here we go. You mentioned that you grew up in Lithuania. What is the one favorite thing you love to do in Lithuania?
Oh, eat cepelini.
So what advice do you give to a young person who wants to be a crypto investor? What's the one piece of advice you give to them?
Diversification.
Interesting. You went to London Business School, as you mentioned in the introduction. If somebody comes to you today and says they want to go to business school, would you recommend them to do so or rather encourage them to do other stuff?
I think it matters. It's probably not as important as the selling department of said business school will give it to you, say it to you, but I think there's value for sure.
A young LBS graduate comes to you and says they want to get into the crypto industry. They have the options between these three jobs: a startup, a crypto startup, a bank, or a regulator? What job do you recommend?
I would recommend all three, but in a particular order. If they're young, they have the horizon necessary. You need to pick it all up. So don't
do them all.
Yeah.
Yeah, you spent a lot of time in Dubai now. What is your favorite thing to do in Dubai?
So one more thing that's probably, a little bit unique about me is I have a set of young twins. They're only 2 years old. So what I like to do is to take them to a swimming pool and watch them splash around.
Here we go. What is your one piece of advice you give to anybody who's moving to Dubai or going to Dubai?
Be prepared to, just one advice. I'll cancel that. Don't look at it as a temporary thing.
Yeah, typical. People go there temporarily and then they end up being there last couple of years. One more question on crypto. So if you had to take a bet on Satoshi, who do you think he, she, or they are, and where are they from?
I think it's probably, and this is not me being sexist, just talking about the year and the age. I think it's going to be a man, and he's going to be from America.
America, here we go. Probably
or France
as well. Yeah. Oh yeah, here we go. Yeah. And the last question on the Future Money podcast. Yev, it was great to have you on the show.
Thank
our typical question at the Future Money show. Yev, if you could have lunch or dinner with one person, who would that be? Lunch or dinner with one person, dead or alive? Who would you have lunch or dinner with?
So that's the only of your buzz questions I was prepared for, Henry. And I really thought very hard about that. I was listening to your previous episodes. And I'd love to give you something really inspiring like Einstein or Stephen Hawking. But do you know what? It'll probably be my granddad. He passed away when I was 11. I think that as in the time frame of a dinner, it would probably be more use.
Amazing. Very, very touching. That was Yeb Bebnev, the Chief Investment Officer of Blockstone Capital. Yeb, if people want to find out more about you or Blockstone Capital, where can they go?
Find me on LinkedIn or simply send me an email. It's yev@blockstonecapital.io. And thank you very much for having me.
It was great having you with us again on the show. Thank you very much, everybody, for this episode. Hope it was insightful. Again, if you like this content, make sure to check out also my YouTube page. We have a lot of exclusive content there available in multiple languages. And also, if you like the podcast, this episode, make sure to really like it. Give it a 5-star review. It really, really helps with more people discovering the show. Once again, guys, thank you very much, everybody, and hope you find the show insightful. And see you all next time.